Good morning, Auroville. This is Abhijit with you again, and I'm broadcasting live from Auroville Radio. And I'm back with my series on exploring education in arts, animation, and filmmaking. Today, I'm covering another topic in filmmaking. So as we are going through the history of filmmaking, today I start with the silent years that ranges from 1910 to 1927. And for today's episode, I specifically cover pre-World War I American cinema. Multiple reel films had appeared in the United States as early as 1907 when Adolf Zukor distributed Pathé's three-reel passion play. But when Vitagraph produced the five-reel The Life of Moses in 1909, the MPPC forced it to be released in serial fashion at the rate of one reel a week. The multi-reel film, which came to be called a feature in the vaudevillian sense of headline attraction, achieved general acceptance with the smashing success of the three and one half reel Les Amours de la Reine Elizabeth, also known as Queen Elizabeth, in 1912, which starred Sarah Bernhardt and was imported by Zukor. In 1912, Enrico Gozzoni's nine-reel Italian super spectacle, Quo Vadis, also known as Whither Are You Going, was roadshown in legitimate theaters across the country at a top admission price of $1, and the feature craze was on. At first, there were difficulties in distributing features because the exchanges associated with both the MPPC and the independents were geared towards cheaply made one-reel shots. Because of their more elaborate production values, features had relatively higher negative costs. This was a disadvantage to distributors who charged a uniform price per foot. By 1914, however, several national film distribution alliances that correlated pricing with a film's negative cost and the box office receipts were organized. These new exchanges demonstrated the economic advantage of multi-reel films over shorts. Exhibitors quickly learned that the features could command higher admission prices and longer runs. Single-title packages were also cheaper and easier to advertise than programs of multiple titles. As for manufacturing, producers found that the higher expenditure for features was readily amortized by high-volume sales to distributors, who in turn were eager to share in the higher admission returns from the theaters. The whole industry soon reorganized itself around the economics of the multiple reel film, and the effects of this restructuring did much to give movies their characteristic modern form. Feature films made motion pictures respectable for the middle class by providing a format that was analogous to that of the legitimate theater and was suitable for the adaptation of middle class novels and plays. This new audience had more demanding standards than the older working class one, and the producers readily increased their budgets to provide high technical quality and elaborate productions. The new viewers also had more refined sense of comfort, which exhibitors quickly accommodated by replacing their storefronts with large, elegantly appointed new theaters in the major urban areas. Known as dream palaces because of the fantastic luxurious of their interiors, these houses had to show features rather than programs of shorts to attract large audiences at premium prices. By 1916, there were more than 21,000 movie theaters in the United States. Their advent marked the end of Nickelodeon era and foretold the rise of Hollywood studio system, which dominated urban exhibition from the 1920s all the way up to 1950s. Before the new studio-based monopoly could be established, however, the patents-based monopoly of the MPPC had to expire. And this it did about 1914 as a result of its own basic assumptions. As conceived by Edison, the basic operating principle of the trust was to control the industry through patents pooling and licensing, an idea logical enough in theory but difficult to practice in the context of a dramatically changing marketplace. Specifically, the trust's failure to anticipate the independent's widespread and aggressive resistance to its policies cost it a fortune in the patent infringement litigation. Furthermore, the trust barely underestimated the importance of the feature film, permitting the independents to claim their popular new product as entirely their own. Another issue that the MPPC misjudged was the power of the marketing strategy known as the STAR system. Borrowed from the theatre industry, this system involves the creation and management of publicity about key performers or stars to stimulate demand of their films. Trust company producers used this kind of publicity after 1910 when Carl Lemille of the Independent Motion Pictures, also known as IMP, promoted Florence Lawrence into the national stardom through a series of media stunts at St. Louis, Missouri, but they never exploited the technique as forcefully or as imaginatively as the independents did. Finally, and most decisively, in August 1912, the U.S. Justice Department brought suit against the MPPC for restraint of trade, in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Delayed by countersuits and by World War I, the government's case was eventually won, and the MPPC formally dissolved in 1918, although it had been functionally inoperative since 1914. The rise and fall of the MPPC was concurrent with the industry's move to Southern California. As a result of the Nickelodeon boom, some exhibitors who showed their separate programs over a 7-day period had begun to require as many as 20 new films per week, and it became necessary to put production on a systematic year-round schedule. Because most films were still shot outdoors in the available light, such schedules could not be maintained in the vicinity of New York City or Chicago, where the industry had originally located itself in order to take advantage of trained theatrical labor pool. As early as 1907, production companies such as Sigil Polyscope began to dispatch production units to warmer climates during winters. It was soon clear that what producers required was a new industrial center, one with warm weather, a temperate climate, and a variety of scenery, and other qualities such as access to acting talent, essential to their highly unconventional form of manufacturing. Various companies experimented with location scouting in Jacksonville, Florida, in San Antonio, Texas, in Santa Fe, in New Mexico, and even in Cuba. But the ultimate site of the American film industry was a Los Angeles suburb, originally a small industrial town called Hollywood. It is generally thought that Hollywood's distance from the MPPC's headquarters in New York City made it attractive to the independents. But MPPC members such as Sigil, Kalem, Biograph, and SNA had also established facilities there by 1911 in response to a number of region's attractions. These included the temperature climate required for a year-round production, a wide range of topography within a 50-mile radius of Hollywood, including mountains, valleys, forests, lakes, islands, seacoast, and even a desert. The status of Los Angeles as a professional theatrical center, the existence of a low-tax base, and the presence of cheap and plentiful labor and the land. This latter factor enabled the newly arrived production companies to buy up tens and thousands of acres of prime real estate on which to locate their studios, standing sets, and backlots. By 1915, approximately 15,000 workers were employed by the motion picture industry in Hollywood, and more than 60% of American production was centered there. In that same year, the trade journal Variety reported that capital investment in American motion pictures, the business of artisanal craftsmen and fairground operators only a decade before, had exceeded $500 million. The most powerful companies in the new film capital were the independents, who were flush with cash from their conversion to feature production. These included the famous players, Lasky Corporation, later known as Paramount Pictures, copywritten in 1927, which was formed by a merger of Zucker's famous player company, Jesse L. Lasky's Feature Play Company and the Paramount Distribution Exchange in 1916. Universal Pictures, founded by Carl Lemille in 1912, by merging IMP with Powers, Rex, Nestor, Champion, and Bison. Goldwyn Pictures Corporation, founded in 1916 by Samuel Goldfish and Edward Selwyn, which combines to Goldwyn. Metro Picture Corporation and Louis B. Mayer Pictures, founded by Louis B. Mayer in 1915 and 1917 respectively. And the Fox Film Corporation, later known as 20th Century Fox, incorporated in 1935, founded by William Fox in 1915. After World War I, these companies were joined by Louis Inc., parent incorporation of MGM, created by the merger of Metro-Goldwyn and Mayer companies cited above, in 1924. A national exhibition chain organized by Marcus Louis and Nicholas Schnech in the 1919, First National Picture Inc., a circuit of independent exhibitors who established their own production facilities in Burbank, California, in 1922. Warner Brothers Pictures Inc., founded by Harry, Albert, Samuel, and Jack Warner in 1923. And last but not the least, Columbia Pictures Inc., incorporated in 1924 by Harry and Jack Cole and Joe Byrne. These organizations became the backbone of Hollywood studio system, and the men who controlled them shared several important traits. They were all independent exhibitors, distributors who had outwitted the trust and earned their success by manipulating finances in the post-Nickelodeon feature boom. Merging production companies, organizing national distribution networks, and ultimately acquiring vast theater chains. They saw their businesses as basically a retailing operation modeled on the practice of chain stores such as the Woolworth and the Sears. Not incidentally, these men were all first or second generation Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, most of them with little formal education, while the audience they served were 90% Protestant and Catholic. This circumstance would become an issue during the 1920s when the movies became a mass medium that was part of the life of every U.S. citizen, and when Hollywood became the chief purveyor of American culture to the world. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you for joining.
This is Oroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.